From WBEZ Chicago and PRX, this is Sound Opinions. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kot. For some bands, every gig requires a costume no matter what month it is.
We'll share our favorite songs from bands who wouldn't dream of going on stage in street clothes. Always a Halloween costume. Plus, we'll review the new album from Art Rockers Battles. And Greg will drop a quarter in the Desert Island Jukebox.
That's all coming up on Sound Opinions. You are listening to Sound Opinions, and later in the show, we're going to review Juice B. Crypt's, the latest album from experimental rock band Battles. But first, we're going to share some songs from bands in costume, Jim.
Yeah, in honor of your favorite holiday ever, Greg, Halloween, you live for this time of year. Listen, you know, pop music in general is about reinventing oneself, crafting a persona that is not necessarily who you are, right? But certain bands, it seems to me, go above and beyond dressing, you know, the role, never being seen sans that costume.
Yeah, every day is Halloween, right? When you're on stage, at least, right? That certainly applied to the first band I want to highlight, Paul Revere and the Raiders from the 60s. They were an Idaho band. And, you know, this garage rock thing was starting up back in the 60s, you know, inspired in a lot of ways by the Beatles and Ed Sullivan. In many ways, Paul Revere and the Raiders presaged that. The leader of the band was actually named Paul Revere. His last name was Dick. He dropped that from a number of reasons, shortened the name. And I think in order to sort of stand out, he thought, you know, let's go whole hog with this Paul Revere concept. I mean, Paul Revere, of course, the Revolutionary War figure immortalized by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow's poem. You know, the British are coming. Well, the British were indeed coming in the 60s. That British invasion was coming as well. Paul Revere and the Raiders were one of the North American responses to that British invasion. R&B styled garage rock. Combined with these corny Revolutionary War style costumes. You know, Paul Revere was wearing these tri-corner hats on stage while playing the keyboards. I mean, you talk about shtick, it sounds so corny, it had to be cornball. But man, those 45s that they put out during that era were pretty tough sounding R&B records. The lead vocals of Mark Lindsay, they had a really, really good guitar player named Drake Levin, who Hendrix actually came to see when the band toured and played in Seattle. And Levin was one of Hendrix's early favorites. You know, he had that flamboyant style. And Levin apparently was an inspiration for some of Hendrix's own flamboyance. The track I want to play from Paul Revere and the Raiders is one of their big hits from 66, Just Like Me on Sound Opinions.
Just like me, it's just like me. I am no fool.
That was Paul Revere in the Raiders, the ultimate costume band from the 60s in many ways, with Just Like Me and Sound Opinions.
You know, their presence in the new Tarantino film, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, underscored why I don't like them. I think the shtick overpowered the music.
I don't see how you wouldn't have seen them on those records. Those records still sound great to me in terms of the context of, R&B-inspired garage rock from the 60s, you know?
Yeah,
they fit right in with that Nuggets compilation.
I'm going to lay some garage rock from the 60s on you for my first pick that is way ahead of its time and where the costumes were not overshadowing the music. The Monks are one of the most fascinating stories in rock history. In the early 60s, you had five American GIs stationed in Germany. They started their band at that point when they were still in the service, and then they all were discharged and kept the band going. Originally, just a regular garage band, pre-Beatles this is, early 60s, and then they changed their name and they changed their outfits. The Torques became the Monks, and they dressed in, monk habits, the rope around the waist. They cut the little patch of hair from the, I think it was called a censure, right? From the back of their heads. I mean, they went full on monk. And that wasn't the only thing that was fascinating. They're playing the tough clubs of the Reeperbahn in Hamburg, which of course is where the Beatles cut their teeth before they put on suits and became mop tops. And they are raw and ragged and bringing in experimental sounds like feedback. At the same time, they have a banjo as one of the five instruments. Legendary were the tales of the one and only album they made in their heyday, Black Monk Time. And then bassist Eddie Shaw, decades later, writes a book of that name, and they become even more mysterious and beloved and great cult figures. And the record finally comes out in 1997 under the aegis of Rick Rubin, Black Monk Time, just post the alternative era. And yeah, it was as weird and forward-looking and chaotic and noisy in 97 as it must have been in 65. Although 65, there had been nothing else like that, right? You know, Eddie is a good writer, really good writer, and he had once said, "A monk is anyone who has a belief and goes into a discipline to achieve a result." That's what these amateur musicians were. And he added, "There's a little monk in all of us." You know, the Monkees had a theme song. Lots of bands in the 60s had a theme song. This was the Monks' theme song, Monks Chant on Sound Opinions. The Monks, Monks Chant or Monk Chant, you see it different ways in different places. Now, Greg, Don't, you know, tell me that doesn't blow Paul Revere away.
I like Paul Revere. I'm sorry. You're not going to get okay. me to back off that stance. Right, I like those right. singles a lot.
Redeem yourself. Give me another costume band pick.
I will. I'm going to go with MF Doom, the rapper, one of the best rappers of the last 20 years. MF Doom, he wears this mask on stage whenever he performs. It's patterned after that Marvel Comics supervillain, Dr. Doom. He uses it to create many personas. You know, there's Danger Doom, there's Doom Starks, JJ Doom, Nehruvian Doom, Metal Face. They've all made albums under this persona. The one I like the best is the Mad Villain persona with Mad Lib, the 2004 record Mad Villainy. Now, MF Doom's been doing this kind of persona thing from the very start of his career. He used to appear in New York City clubs in the late 90s wearing a woman's stocking over his head. So anonymity is something this guy craved so that he could be more playful in the way he appeared. He has abused this privilege in some years. People have said that he has performed, he has sent up an imposter in that mask to perform his some of his concerts. And eventually he did own up to saying, yeah, I did send up another guy in my stead, a few stand-ins yeah. along the way to further play with the concept. But it's all MF Doom on these records, and you can hear it very clearly on the Mad Villainy LP. I think it's a masterpiece of the 2000s in collaboration with the producer Mad Lib. Here's a track from that record. It's called Accordion from Mad Villain on Sound Opinion.
Off borrowed time, the clock tick faster. That'll be the hour they knock the slick blaster. Dick Dastardly and Muttley with sick laughter. A gunfight and they come to cut the mix master. ICE Cole, nice to be old. Y2G Steve, twice to threefold. He sold scrolls, lo and behold. Know who's the illest ever, like the greatest story told. Keep your glory, gold, and glitter. For half of his to take him out the picture. The other half is rich and it don't mean. Villain, a mixture between both with a twist of liquor, chasing with more beer. Tasting like truth or dare when he at the mic, it's like the place get like, oh yeah. It's like they know what's about to happen. Just keep your eye out like I capping. Is he still a fly guy clapping if nobody ain't hear it? And can they testify from in the spirit? And living the true gods, giving y'all nothing but the like two broads. Got more lyrics than the church, got ooh lords. And he hold the mic in your attention like two swords. Or either one with two blades on it. Hey you, don't touch the mic like it's AIDS on it. Yeah, it's like the end to the means. The type of message that sends to the fiends. That's why he bring his own needles and get more cheese than Doritos, Cheetos or Fritos. Slip like Freudian, your first and last step to playing yourself like accordion. When he at the mic, you don't go next. Leaving cats like wild hoes need Kotex. Exercise index won't need Bowflex and won't take the one with no skinny legs like Joe Tex.
That was MF Doom in his Mad Villain persona from the Mad Villainy LP in 2004 with a track called Accordion, The Man in the Mask. Jim, what do you got next for us?
Well, Greg, when you were talking about imposters going out on occasion for MF Doom, who is a genius, you know, of course, Kraftwerk did that, too. You know, they had numerous costumes through the years, some of them questionably politically incorrect. You know, and sometimes they wanted to send out the robots to tour for them. I think it's a great idea. As far as I know, my next costume band has never sent out imposters, although they have not been seen in the flesh since the late 90s. I'm talking about Daft Punk, of course. Guy Manuel de Homem Christo and Thomas Bangalter, the Parisian duo, I don't think it's an exaggeration to say, is one of the most important bands in electronic pop music, dance music in the last 25 years. From the influence they've had over everybody in that genre and other people like Kanye West building tracks on them, what they've done with electronic instruments, I think, pushes the boundary of where Kraftwerk had left it by the beginning of the 80s. They used to go out and just be themselves, but nobody cared about them at that point. They really, you know, started to become revered when they put on the robot helmets. Mm-hmm. And they have said, we as people, we're not models. You know, we're not performers, but the robots are exciting to people. And that's true. You know, two guys on stage with a bunch of computers and electronic instruments versus two robots, that's exciting. Not the only reason they're great by any means. I think I'm having a different standard here. Certainly MF Doom was great, but I'm still fighting you on Paul Revere. You know, I think the costumes have to be as great as the music. And certainly that's the case with Daft Punk. I'm going to one of the early tracks, Robot Rock, which really tells their whole story and throws down the gauntlet. Daft Punk on Sound Opinions. Daft Punk, Robot Rock, like Kraftwerk, we are the robots.
We want to throw this out to our listeners. Do you love a band in uniform? Call and leave a message on our hotline with your answer and why, 888-859-1800, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. After a break, Jim and I are going to share more songs from bands in costume. That's all coming up on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Jim DeRogatis. He's Greg Kot. He's in costume today in honor of the Halloween season because we are talking about musicians whose costumes played a key role in the stage persona, sometimes in the music. Greg, you've got another pick.
I do, Jim. An extremely talented vocalist and performer, Jay Hawkins, who became Screamin' Jay Hawkins in the 50s, was struggling to make a name for himself until he put on a costume. His big breakthrough song was I Put a Spell on You in 1956. He apparently went in the studio with his band, got roaring drunk, and out came this song. The results of which made him a huge star around the country, enabling him to do a nationwide tour. It was suggested to him rather strongly by DJ Alan Freed, who was supporting this record, that, hey, I'll give you $300 if you jump out of a coffin on stage.
Yep.
and Hawkins is like, what? What are you talking about? But he was persuaded to give it a shot, got himself a cape. The next thing you know, he's being photographed with the bone nose rings and wearing gold and leopard skin costumes and adorning his stage with smoking skulls on a stick. By the way, the skull was named Henry, Jim. I thought you'd want to know that.
Yes, they were close.
And rubber snakes as well, yeah. You know, later on, he had a song called Constipation Blues, and he outfitted that with a makeshift bathroom on stage. I mean, this guy really got into the theatrical presentation.
Not always in good taste.
No. And he later on told some interviewers that he was sad that the fact that he had this amazing operatic range as a vocalist and as a singer took a back seat to the flamboyance, and he somewhat regretted some of it. But nonetheless, we remember him for this remarkable song, for sure. I Put a Spell on You from Screamin' Jay Hawkins on Sound Opinions.
I put a spell on you. I because you're mine. Stop the things you do. What's up?
That is Screamin' Jay Hawkins. I Put a Spell on You. I still get a smile on my face when I hear that from one of the greats.
One of the most important songs in rock history, period, and a favorite of a writer we're going to talk about a little later in the show. Greg, we never compare our picks in advance, but we're on some sort of kismet karma thing this week for costume bands because I got somebody that used Bones a lot, too, and I got somebody else, you know, with an operatic range. I am talking about King Diamond of King Diamond fame and also Merciful Fate. Now, obviously, there is much costume tomfoolery in the metal genre. Not all of it that I will endorse, you know. I wouldn't give you a dime for Slipknot, and don't even bring up Gwar in my presence. But I think King Diamond, in all of his incarnations, is a true great of thrash metal, goth metal, whatever you want to call the many genres he's been pursuing since the 80s. Born in Denmark as a human being, Kim Bendix Petersen, he found his niche when he put on the corpse paint for the first time. Before anybody else in metal did it. I mean, now you go to a metal fest and 9 out of 10 bands have got corpse paint. But King Diamond was doing it first. He was doing it with, he claimed, 2 human bones set up as a cross as his microphone stand. He was doing it with an extraordinary vocal range and a magnetic personality. He said he was initially inspired by Alice Cooper, yet another costumed fellow. But, you know, I really think I would take the Merciful Fate and King Diamond solo catalogs over a lot of what Alice has done, except for those couple, maybe 2-3 early on Detroit-era Alice Cooper records. A mix of genres, a penchant for storytelling, sometimes conceptual works, usually about people coming back from the dead or being, you know, dispatched to the dead. He is a practicing Satanist, he will tell you, and not just for pose. He can give lengthy discourses on that philosophy. Again, though, I don't think the shtick ever takes a backseat to the quality of the music. I'm going right to the start of the Merciful Fate career, the 1983 debut album, the most ambitious track on it, co-written by King Diamond with Hank Sherman, the guitarist. 11-plus minutes, Satan's Fall. I would love to play it all for you because, you know, it doesn't get much better around the Halloween season. But it was a key track in a lot of ways that they went back and re-recorded several times in different guises. It just kept getting longer, you know. But it's all good. Satan's Fall by King Diamond. Merciful Fate was the band on Sound Opinions. Wow, man, Evil on Bloodstained Wings. You gotta love Merciful Fate. You gotta love King Diamond. You know, he actually had a heart attack on stage in 2010, Greg. He's finally slowed down a bit. He's 63 now, but he had triple bypass surgery. Even that didn't kill King Diamond.
Still rocking, though, huh?
Yeah.
Speaking of operatic voices, let's go for three in a row. Glenn Danzig, right? There's a guy with a huge voice. His first band didn't really get to display that voice quite as much, but the Misfits were, for a certain generation of punk rockers, were one of those go-to bands. They were a rite of passage. The Misfits were a band that grabbed you by the collar and wouldn't let go. It had a perfect mix of these simple but anthemic songs combined with this love, fascination with B-horror and science fiction films that the band started to emulate on stage in the way they outfitted themselves. They painted skeletons on their clothes. They had dark makeup around their eyes. They had those devil locks of hair hanging down from their forehead down to their chins. Horror punk, you know, a little mini genre of punk that included bands like The Damned and The Cramps and TSOL around this era. The band's first gig was at CBGB in the late 70s, and lo and behold, they played what is being billed as their last show just a few weeks ago, once again in New York, this time at Madison Square Garden. That tells you how big that band became over those decades.
After Ramones, I think that is the number one selling T-shirt in all of rock history. The Misfits.
Yeah, it's incredible that they have had this lock on generations, multi-generations now, of young punks. A real important band in terms of their influence. And here's where it all began, with a song called Night of the Living Dead. It was a single that was released, appropriately enough, on Halloween night, 1979, from the Misfits on Sound Opinions. Mighty Misfits on Sound Opinions. That's where it all began. Night of the Living Dead. Imagine those jack-o'-lanterns on stage at Madison Square Garden. You know?
Despite being from the same stomping grounds of Jersey, I have got to confess, I have never gotten the Misfits. But, you know, if you're talking about costume bands, which we've been doing, there's no way to avoid KISS, right? The most successful band of all time. We're talking about the Misfits having become a merchandise machine. Well, nobody did it better than Kiss, right? But I will not stoop to play Kiss on this show. I think we played them once. I won't play Kiss. I will, however, acknowledge their influence in costumes with costume characters, cartoons come to life, a comic book in rock form or rock in a comic book form by playing Priss. Do you know who Priss is, Greg?
I do not.
There are legions of Kiss copy bands, right? Because you're in the costume. Who knows who's behind all that makeup anyway, right? But there are several, including one in Chicago, female costume Kiss bands, tribute bands. And I love this idea because they were such sexist, misogynistic boneheads. But to have women put on those costumes and take those songs and redeem them somewhat, it's like the musical version of that famous piece by my friend, a pioneering rock critic, Jan Uhelski, who dressed up and went on stage with Kiss in the 70s, famous piece, I Dreamed I Was on Stage with Kiss in My Maiden Form Bra. You know, so I was like, I love the idea of women taking something back from Gene Simmons and his cohorts and doing it for Terry Gross, right? I just love this idea. And they also have the marketing down. On the Pris website, these young women are from the West Coast. They note, Pris is the perfect band for fundraisers, promotion, film, and TV appearances, as well as private parties. We can do it all. You know, they're ready to sell out the great consumerist capitalist dream that was Gene Simmons and Kiss. Here they are doing Detroit Rock City, Pris, on Sound of Business. Come on, Greg. Everybody got to rock tonight. Detroit Rock City, not by Kiss, but by Pris. If you've got a favorite band in costume, give us a call, 888-859-1800, or connect with us on Facebook or Twitter. Coming up, we'll review the fourth album by Battles, Juice B. Crips, and Greg will pop a quarter in the Desert Island Jukebox. Greg, what do you got in store?
Jim, I'm going to pay tribute to one of our favorite rock critics who died recently by playing a song from one of his favorite artists.
That's in a minute on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX. Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Jim DeRogatis. He's Greg Kot, and that is a little bit of Battles, a duo from New York, from its fourth album, Juice B. Crypt. The song was called They Played It Twice. Greg, we've reviewed Battles pretty much from the beginning of their career, several EPs early on, a group that was formed by some key members of other bands that had made a big impact, including Helmet, and Tomahawk, and Don Caballero. The two key members, John Stainier and Ian Williams, at different times they had other collaborators, the guitarist David Konopka, and the great vocalist Tayunde Braxton. Now they're a duo. I thought they'd been gone, and I thought, as I look back over the reviews we've given them over the years, they'd never quite matched the brilliance of that early song, Atlas. I kept waiting for them to do it. Now they're back with a fourth album, which has some really, really interesting collaborators. We heard Xenia Rubios on that track we played a little of. They played it twice. Toon Yards is working with Battles on a couple of songs. John Anderson, the vocalist of Yes, which makes sense. There's a lot of progressive rock in this duo. And we were just talking about great bass lines a couple of weeks ago. I mentioned Liquid Liquid as one of my all-time favorites. Sal Principato of that groundbreaking New York art rock group is on this record as well. I think that makes sense. In many ways, Battles has been to the New York avant-garde underground pop scene, taking elements of pop and elements of weird experimental, doing what Liquid Liquid did way back in the 80s. Let's play a song from Juice B. Crypt, the fourth album by Battles on Sound Opinions. This is Titanium Two-Step.
That is Titanium Two-Step from the new Battles album, Juice B. Crypts. It's, as Jim mentioned, Liquid Liquid's Sal Principato is the vocalist on that track, on an album rife with guest vocalists. Jim, I think the variety of the vocalists that you pointed out, and you know, everybody from Toon Yards to Yes's John Anderson, speaks to the ambition of this band and sort of the mix-and-match sensibility of their music. In a lot of ways, this is the densest album they've made. There are layers upon layers of rhythms and textures in this record that you could get lost in. What's the view like up in the sky? Is there a cloud stuck in your eye? It approximates, to me, both cutting-edge, you know, mix-and-match hip-hop as well as progressive rock. I mean, it's an interesting mix of styles here. Not to lose the fact that, Stanier and Williams have a pedigree in guitar, drums, rock combos, and they haven't lost that element as well. So they're blending this very traditional style of indie rock with these progressive elements in a really fascinating way. I think, for my money, this is the best record they've made since that debut that you've mentioned with Atlas on it. The sort of frantic quality of a lot of these songs almost reminds me of cartoon music at times. Yep. And you would think that something this ambitious and this layered is going to be really cerebral, but there's a real playful quality to this stuff. You can spaz out to this stuff on the dance floor, you can slap on the headphones and get lost inside those mixes, and then, you know, I think this would be just an amazing soundtrack for like an amusement park ride. You know, I could see Battles playing, you know, on a really high-tech roller coaster or something like that. So I really love this record.
Greg, you're not kidding when you say cartoon music. We have referenced the names Carl Stalling and Raymond Scott several times. probably without ever explaining them. We should do a whole segment sometime.
Yeah.
Those were the two pioneering genius composers, among the first to use synthesizers, who did all the music for the Looney Tune cartoons, right? And if you think about a typical Bugs Bunny cartoon or anybody in the Looney Tunes cast of characters, you know, things change every 20 seconds. Genres, styles, insane mix-ups, mash-ups. The Boys in Battles have said that they were setting out to do a blender of modern electronic music, and that is absolutely true. But it is not just an experiment. It is a fun time thrill ride. I hate to be the absent-minded professor. I don't know if I told this story. It would have been when we were talking about Rocky Erickson. But the great psychedelic philosopher has been on my mind lately, Terrence McKenna, because there's a wonderful new documentary that's getting a lot of raves in the underground film world about mushrooms, right? And this theory that a long time ago, before we evolved into humanity, the cave people ate magic mushrooms and suddenly, like, discovered the wheel and fire, and their brains grew 10 times bigger, right? This is the sound of taking the magic mushrooms and meeting what Terrence McKenna said were the elves who run the universe, right? A shared hallucination among indigenous people and modern people who've taken the psychedelic drug DMT, that this is what the elves sound like when they're jamming and running the machinery.
It favors the mold, scorched them, left his body cold, broke the mold. Break the gold, stack the fold, pressure overload, adhere, beware, the dark cold young hustler.
I love this album. I never thought we'd get anything this brilliant from Battles again. I'm so glad we have.
I tell you, little buddy, this whole island is bewitched.
As often as possible, we take a trip to the Desert Island Jukebox, pop a quarter in, and play a song we can't live without. Greg, we have a sad reason to play today's, I know.
Yes, we do, Jim. Nick Toshis, a great music writer, a great writer, period, a literary figure of the last four or five decades, it must be said, dead at the age of 69. He was a friend who was both encouraged us both and left behind a huge legacy of brilliant writing. Obviously for us, you know, I come into Toshis as the rock critic. He was one of the more flamboyant writers of the late 60s, early 70s, who really established that persona form of writing. Lester Bangs, obviously, was an advocate of that as well. But in contrast to the more intellectual end of the rock spectrum in those early days, you know, people like Robert Christgau and Grail Marcus, Toshis was a brilliant writer who was also dismissive of a lot of the ridiculousness that he heard in rock and wrote brilliantly about it. He especially was great at sort of just, you know, skewering bands who were in it for all the wrong reasons, the commercialism that was even apparent in that era, and at the same time championing the true individuals in the music scene. His book on country music, The Biggest Music in America, in 1977, that was his first book, championing obscure country music figures like Emmett Miller and Cliff Carlisle, really opened my eyes to what I thought had just been, you know, was corny music at the time when I was a, you know, a teenager. Hearing and reading Toshis writing about country music really opened my eyes. And then at a time when there were very few really credible rock biographies, his bio of Jerry Lee Lewis, Hellfire, remains one of the great rock bios. In fact, a template that I think every other bio has been aiming for in terms of just the accomplishment of it.
Well, we're asked fairly often, you know, the best rock books ever, and that's always on our short list. I think we've even said that on the show.
Yeah, and you know, he had he followed that up 10 years later with another great music biography of Dean Martin, Dino, living high in the dirty business of dreams. But Jim, you also were a student of his literary work. I read his bio of Liston. In fact, I had a small part in helping him research that book. But you're a fan of everything he's written, really, aren't you?
I'm a fan of everything he's written. And there are four extraordinary novels. I first met Nick in 1988 when his first novel came out, Cut Numbers. It's a classic of, you know, Jersey mob kind of stuff. If you're a fan of Scorsese and, you know, The Godfather, it's brilliant. But, you know, this is a guy who never went to college, barely graduated high school, told me many times, I got my education in the New York Public Library. You know, learn to speak, you know, Latin circa the 1500s so that he could read Dante's Inferno in its original, not a translation, in the hand of Dante's, a brilliant book. But I think Nick went out on a high note. You know, it did not get nearly the literary acclaim it should have. But his 2015 novel, Under Tiberius, I think is the greatest thing he ever did. And I think his heart was a little broken that that book did not get the attention of some of his others. So perhaps start with Hellfire and Dino, move on to Hand of Dante and Under Tiberius, but read everything this man ever wrote. Is my advice.
I can't disagree with that. And at the same time, I would say for a novice Tosh's fan or would-be Tosh's fan, the Nick Tosh's Reader is not a bad place to start.
Yes.
Giving you a nice overview of the range of his work, in which you it includes some of his writing on Jerry Lee Lewis, which I think is by far the best stuff I've ever read on one of the pioneers of rock and roll. And in tribute to Nick's greatness in writing about Jerry Lee, I want to play a track from an album that probably doesn't get the love that it should. It doesn't rank with Jerry Lee Lewis's records from Sun Records in Memphis in the 50s in terms of its sales and influence. But Jerry Lee Lewis's 1964 live album, recorded at the Star Club in Hamburg, Germany, remains one of the great live albums ever made. He recruited this small band that included the drummer for the Animals at the time. And it is a rompin', stompin', crushing example of a rock and roll great at the height of his powers, basically flipping the bird to the British invasion and saying, you want rock and roll? You get a load of this. This is his version of Little Richard's Good Golly Miss Molly from that album on Sound Opinions.
Good golly Miss Molly, baby, you're so like the ball.
Good Golly Miss Molly by Jerry Lee Lewis in homage to Nick Tosh's dead at the age of 69. Back on the Reaper Bomb there from Live at the Star Club. You know, Greg, no one would have thought that Nick Tosh's would die before Jerry Lee Lewis.
Yeah, it is indeed sad. And the fact that Tosh's left so much great work is the only solace we can take from that.
What do we have on the show next week?
Next week, Jim, another late, great Janis Joplin, a fantastic new biography of Janis Joplin. We're going to talk to the author of that book.
For more Sound Opinions, listen to our podcast wherever you find such things. We've also got a vibrant discussion group growing on Facebook. We do check in and read everything, and we believe in giving listeners their say. As always, this show is produced by Brendan Banasak, Alex Claiborne, Ayanna Contreras, and Andrew Gill.
Number to call if you want my loving. Number to call if you want turtle loving. Number I'm waiting all night long, just waiting and waiting for you to phone Bigelow 624.
On Sound Opinions, everyone's a critic, so give us a call on our hotline, 888-859-1800.
New messages.
Got it sweet like an angel.
Hey,
Hey, my name is Bart. I'm calling from Nashville. I just wanted to thank y'all for doing your Exile on Main Street show. It's one heck of an album, one of my top favorites. My history with Exile was being born in 76, and at 16 in the 90s, my neighbor gave it to me because I always drove him to school every day.
But the guy in danger, yeah, the guy in chains, but you keep on pushing.
She had gone to a record store and probably asked, what's a great album to give somebody? And he gives that to me, and I just was not hip to it. I couldn't handle it. I loved rock and roll, was into Zeppelin, all that stuff, but just couldn't get it. And I put it on the shelf with all the other CDs, and about 8 years later, I pick it up again. And it blew my mind. And from then on, it has been one of the top three albums that are my favorite. But thanks for doing this show, guys.
My name is Bob Beatty. I'm calling from Nashville, Tennessee, and just had to sort of follow up on a point y'all made during the show that if you're new to Exile on Main Street, you're not going to get it right away. I had just commented to a friend in text while I was listening to y'all that as a seasoned music listener for 30-something years, it took me that long until Exile finally sunk into my craw properly and where it belongs, period, and you know, for all time. And that's because it's such a phenomenal record. And it is not easy to hear in the first place, as the great Lester Bang said.
Shake your hip, man. Shake your hip, man. Well, you don't know, don't be no afraid. Just listen to me. That's what I say.
Hey, Jim and Greg, this is Greg from Las Vegas. Just wanted to say, awesome show regarding Exile on Main Street. That and Beggar's Banquet are my two favorite Stones records, and I put them up with London Calling and Jesus and Mary Chain. Psycho Candy is just almost perfect records, man. So I loved it. Keep it up. Talk to you soon.
Hey there, this is Laura from Seattle, Washington. Exile on Main Street, favorite Stones album ever. And I think that was the album that just made me get all of it. Life and love and music and just about finding yourself and finding your way in the world. Thanks for dissecting and analyzing and loving it tonight. What a great show.
I'm calling from Florida. I listen to WUSF. It's Saturday, almost 3 o'clock, and enjoying your show about Exile on Main Street and the Rolling Stones. They're a great band. It's a great rock and roll album. You guys are picking up on all the subtle touches of recording from L.A. to the basements in France. Keep up the good work. Enjoy the show. Bye.
No more messages.
To give us your opinions on Sound Opinions, call our hotline, 888-859-1800. We'll be back next week with more Sound Opinions, produced by WBEZ Chicago and distributed by PRX.